A baseball game, a day in a park with friends and family, fishing in a remote stream, work, travels, providing for loved ones, or heading out for adventures. Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. The original Guide to Men's Health is presented by the Washington State Urology Society to help take you through the steps necessary to get the most out of life. If you have invested in a retirement plan for your future, why not invest in your body? After all, it makes better sense to retire healthy and enjoy your future. These podcasts are a guide for how to take care of yourself. If you take care of your car and maintain it, why not do the same for your personal machine, your body? If you know you should but haven't yet, the information in these podcasts contains some easy recommendations for where, when, and how to get started. Follow the podcast as we explore men's health with renowned experts and embark on a journey towards better health. Dependency and addictions, important topics in this day and age. We have an opiate crisis. Maybe you know somebody who needs help. Maybe a family member, relative, or friend. Or maybe you yourself have suffered from addictions or dependencies. On this episode of the original Guide to Men's Health, we'll be exploring dependency and addiction with an expert. Today we interview Dr. David Taubin, MD. Dr. Taubin is chief of the Division of Pain Medicine, a clinical professor of medicine, anesthesiology, and pain medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine. His practice is currently at the University of Washington Center for Pain Relief. He has practiced 30 years of primary care and internal medicine and now concentrates his efforts on addiction, dependency, and pain. Welcome, Dr. Taubin.
My pleasure to be part of this conversation.
So let's start for a background into the difference between dependency and addiction.
Very important difference, and it's very confusing even for clinicians who are trying to manage either addiction as a condition and even pain, since we use medications that produce what we call physical dependence.
Looking at a dependency, it would be recognizable to most people that an addiction would come from use of something like heroin. We're now seeing it as addiction to opiates. But how do they become dependent? I guess that's what's a transition, that you're dependent on something, but then do you become addicted? Or are they separate?
Yeah, so this distinction is very important. It's important really for people who are, as you mentioned in the introduction, exposed through family and friends, since it's about 2 degrees of separation right now in opioid overdose deaths. And opioids are used for pain. So in the interface management of pain medicine, we really encounter large numbers of individuals who've been prescribed opioids for pain and other drugs that produce dependence in an effort to manage their pain. And most of them are not addicted. However, if they don't have the opioid, they get very sick. They go into physical withdrawal and sometimes seem to be addicts when in fact they've developed a physiological or a biological condition that is called dependence. Addiction is a behavioral disorder. It's how you respond as a behavior. Dependence is a biological condition, which represents the body's requirement to continue to be exposed to an agent, a drug, in this case, that without having that in your system produces very significant physical symptoms, disabling symptoms, and highly distressing symptoms.
So we could imagine easily somebody who is utilizing opioids that were prescribed, continued to utilize them, and continued to utilize them, and then develop dependency on them.
In fact, we would expect someone to become physically dependent. It would be unusual after a prolonged interval to be prescribed opioids, to take them just as prescribed, to do everything that the prescriber has asked, have done nothing wrong at all, and they will become physically dependent.
Patient has surgery, doctor says, use this, it's safe. What is the safe period?
Every individual varies, but as a general rule, if you're using opioids on prescription for longer than 90 days, you are very likely to have a great deal of difficulty stopping those opioids. There's fairly good data that suggests that two-thirds of people who are on opioids for 3 months are going to be on opioids for the rest of their life. Complicated reasons, it gets caught up in the pain diagnosis, but also the discontinue of opioids after a prolonged period of exposure produces physical pain. That's part of the withdrawal syndrome. And that physical pain often locates at the original painful site. So they become conflated. Is this the pain or is it the withdrawal? But the data supports 90 days as a worrisome interval. We know that to get to 90 days, you've been taking them for 10, 30, 60 days. So you get to that dose. So current recommendations are at 6 weeks of being on an opioid, you better have a plan. You develop with your prescriber, the physician or nurse practitioner who's been prescribing those, to get off before you hit this 90-day benchmark.
Opioids, there's various strengths and various dosages and various types. I know Tylenol with codeine isn't that strong, but I imagine you could get addicted even to that, but it would probably be difficult. But usually what's prescribed are stronger. When people have a tendency to like what they're taking in that state, maybe 30 days into it, they want to continue taking it. Is that an issue where they're not really using it for pain control, but something else is intervening here?
It's a really good question. We use, if you really like the drug, it's a problem. If you feel normal, or this is the first time I really felt well, it's a problem. The experience of feeling high when you take that. The statement that I've never felt this good in my life after you take the drug. And if you get that after one dose, it's a potential problem. Over 80% of people who, when they're exposed to an opioid, say, yuck, I don't want to have to take this drug. And they self-discontinue. In fact, the vast majority of people don't like the feeling. They take it for pain. It's better to have less pain, to put up with the side effects. But the feeling of this really feels good is a danger sign, and it could be after one dose. So time matters based on how you react to the single exposure.
Both the prescriber and the recipient ought to be aware of that signal. And if I'm a prescriber, I ought to get in contact with my post-operative patient who I've given a narcotic to and say, by the way, are you finding this euphoric, or is this bringing you pleasures other than just relief of pain? Is that a legitimate question for a practitioner to ask?
It's a great question. And in fact, are you using this for more than just the relief of pain? Or are you feeling high from this drug? Or is this drug making you feel better than you've ever felt before? That would be very legitimate questions.
And that would be also from the patient who's taking it to bring up and say, you know, call the doc and go, I have to tell you something about this medicine you just prescribed for me.
And that would be excellent outcome if people felt comfortable enough saying that. There's a fear that if they say they like it too much, I'm an addict and I'm not going to get medication for pain relief. So it is a dialogue that is encouraged, hard for both ends. The surgeon, as you well know, is a busy guy or gal, and a complicated discussion interrupts their workflow in the course of the day and gets into issues that is really not part of their scope of practice. And similarly, the last thing a patient wants to do is suffer needless pain. But yes, if we could get to that clarity of recognizing that it feels really good when I take this medicine, not just it really covers my pain to the degree that I can now function and tolerate the recovery problem, post-surgical recovery problem or injury or whatever else the opiate might prescribe for, that would be an ideal state.
Now, in a separate episode, we'll talk about modern concepts of pain management and what all the other alternatives there are, but let's dive a little more into this scenario. Let's have a patient who is not post-operative, is not getting a prescription, but is looking for recreation.
We don't know exactly how many people who do that activity, i.e. take it for the pleasure of it just to see what it feels like, become opioid use disorder patients or opiate addicts, but it's at least 30%. So that's a 1 in 3 chance that this is going to turn into a serious problem.
So they're almost separating themselves from the group who's taken for pain control, who might become addicted, who might find, hey, I find this a pleasurable sensation, to the person who's taking it recreationally is already sort of going down that road looking for something.
Well, they're seeking pleasure, not seeking pain relief. Seeking pleasure from an opioid is a dangerous behavior, and that would actually represent a blinking red flag to developing an opiate use disorder, which is the term for addiction. We took the word addiction out because it's so stigmatized. Now we have a scientific word to describe it, opiate use disorder. It's cleaner, but it's really talking about the same thing. I think the characteristics for a public audience is a pretty simple one, and it applies not just to opioids, but to sedative medications and other substances. People get hooked on cocaine, methamphetamine, alcohol, major culprits out there, are the three C's, the letter C. So using a substance and being unable to control your use, which means, oh, I'll just go to a party, there's some pills, I'll try one, and one turns to three, which turns to 10, and becomes not the intended outcome. So losing control over that substance is a key characteristic. The second is compulsive use. And that means, well, I feel a little socially ill at ease, but if I have a little bit of oxy in my system, oxycodone or oxycontin in my system, I just feel more relaxed and more sociable, and it just makes the event feel better. And the third and really most important one in the long run is having negative consequences from taking the drug. And opioids have really negative consequences because price of heroin now and illegal fentanyl right now is so low compared to even prescribed drugs. And they are extraordinarily dangerous because you don't know what you're getting. Many of them require injections, which produce not only hepatitis C, but HIV and infectious complications in the skin, infections in the bloodstream, heart valve infections, skin and soft tissue infections. And we just have to go to the county hospital here to see the tragedy of medical consequences. But the consequences don't have to be medical. They can also be social. And the social consequences begin with your friends, with your family, with loved ones, that you're not the same person anymore. And you become disconnected from your social and meaningful role, hard to hold a job, hard to stay in the game of life, and to continue to use in the face of adverse consequences represents the third of the three C's. And they tend to progress, but they can happen out of sequence, and they can happen rapidly as well. So just trying an opioid out to see how it feels is a very dangerous proposition.
I would like to just explore the concern of dependency versus the addiction. Somebody who goes down that road of, I want to try this to feel good. What is the physiology of addiction? Am I using the correct term?
Yeah, that's exactly the correct term. So physiology refers to how organ systems and bodily functions
work. What happens is that they take that, I feel good, but something else is going on. And we move this from being punitive, like you said. We don't want to really refer to this as a habit or we're trying to change the concept of people around, people who meet these people, so we're not punitive. We want them to get help. But there is a physiologic change that occurs. It becomes a medical issue. It becomes a disease. What have we learned about that recently?
Well, getting to the basic nuts and bolts. So an opioid is a molecule, and it binds to a receptor in the body. It's called the mu for morphine, and the Greek letter for M for morphine is mu. So it's the mu receptor, or the mu opiate receptor. If you go on Wikipedia, you'll see M-O-R, mu opiate receptor. And the mu opiate receptor exists in enormous numbers in the human body, at multiple locations. It exists in the periphery, so out at the pain sensation site. It exists in the transmitting stations of that, we call them the ganglii, of the nerves as they enter into the central nervous system. They exist in the spinal cord. They exist in the brainstem. They exist in the subcortical structures that regulate emotion, that regulate hormones, and in reference to men's health, I'll make the point, it just clobbers your testosterone by interfering with the releasing hormones, and it stops them. It interferes with oxytocin, which is commonly referred to in women as being an important hormone for establishing pregnancy and nursing. But men have it too, and that's called the bonding hormone. So it interferes with social interactions. It interferes with your cortisone levels. So that's referring to your energy. It interferes with immune function in the periphery. And it interferes with memory, social adaptation, and our ability to think clearly. It interferes with our respiratory drive, leading to overdoses because we stop breathing. So it has enormous distribution. It's a substance that exists in nature, poppy, and the molecules exist in most evolved life forms as an essential component in the normal human and animal function. So it's a big deal. So you activate the receptor, you have an effect. That effect triggers a sense of euphoria in patients for whom it's an at-risk. So the euphoric effect is modulated through dopamine receptors and pleasure centers and other reward centers that are in more in the brain than in the periphery, where we feel and we have our conscious experience. If that is really feeling good, desire to keep that feeling remains. However, body gets used to the exposure. After a short while, and it varies in individuals, but certainly within 4 weeks, we call neuroplasticity changes. And the body says, oh, okay, I don't need to have as many receptors because I have so much of these opioids circulating. So they down-regulate. So the numbers of receptors decreases and their responsiveness to a normal opioid exposure from our endorphins becomes stunted. And if you stop that exposure, the body says, where is it? I need it. And that's withdrawal. The physical dependence is a combination of enough prolonged exposure to reduce the sensitivity of the normal opioid response to one where there is no opioid present and you feel badly when you don't have the opioid. And so opioid, regular user of opioids who becomes dependent feels normal. So the high goes away and the struggle to just feel normal takes place. And that then drives the addiction problem. And so the acquisition of the drug is necessary in order to feel normal. The pleasure's gone. It's the prevention of the lack of that drug that people seek those drugs. They don't get high anymore. They just feel normal. And the absence of the drug has them feeling sick because all the systems I mentioned are no longer functioning in a normal fashion.
When somebody starts down that road, is part of that receptor issue going to change their consciousness where it becomes the norm? Where, yes, I'm getting euphoria, but over some time where it's kind of becomes the standard, the universe, the paradigm shifts.
Exactly. And to feel normal, you need the agent in your system. And the response of the system is further potentiated by immediate surge. So people will shoot the drug to go right to the brain or smoke the drug because inhalation of an opioid bypasses the normal distribution and it goes right to the brain. So rapidly acting, rapid onset opioids become more desirable. And that's where we get into fentanyl, which goes right to the brain and binds rapidly to the brain and it drives even more craving because of the rapid effect. Heroin also goes rapidly to the brain based on its properties, and injecting the drug is even more potent. You know, we hear about people smoking oxycodone, for instance. So the quicker acting the drug is, the more likely it's going to potentiate that euphoric effect, which then wanes, and you need a higher dose. That's the development of tolerance to develop that. And again, as we've mentioned several times, to not have it, it's not like not being euphoric. It's like not feeling normal. It's like feeling awful, depressed, withdrawn, runny nose, muscle cramping, chills, diarrhea, really a miserable feeling. It's not life-threatening. People don't die of opiate withdrawal like they can with alcohol withdrawal or some other drugs, but they feel like they'd like to die. So the drive to continue to acquire the drug becomes the sole purpose of their life, seeking the drug on a continuous basis to maintain a sense of normalcy is the pathway that folks who use the drugs experimentally in the beginning, but become addicted to the opioid in that circumstance.
And it is an overwhelming addiction. I mean, it seems in the addicted patients that I have met, it becomes the focus of life.
It is life. It's the acquisition of the drug. That's one of the formal criteria, an overwhelming time spent acquiring or seeking to acquire the drug. It's on your mind all day. When am I going to get the drug? When am I going to be able to take the drug? How am I going to afford to take the drug? How am I going to keep it a secret from my family, my friends, my workplace? That's full-blown addiction. That's a later stage, but it creeps up on people. They get seduced by the sensation of euphoria or the euphoria-seeking behavior. And often they're the last to recognize. So I think your comment about it early on, asking your clinician, is this going to be a problem? Or noticing this in your loved one, that they're just not the same. Patients describe when they come off opioids, even on prescriptions after long term, they don't feel like a zombie anymore. We did a study here. We threw people off medically prescribed opioids. What was remarkable, done well under medical supervision, even on the prescribed, even very high doses, with their agreement that this was an important thing to do, they bought into it, that in the conversations, the informal discussions, not the data set that we're collecting for the science, but in the interviews, the most common word that people used was zombie. My husband, wife, sister, brother, mother, daughter is no longer a zombie. Zombies are imaginary creatures that are not people. They're bodies. They're bodies that don't have emotional connection. They don't have social connection. They're just not human anymore. So not feeling like a zombie is a good thing. So you could ask your patient's spouse or significant other or loved one, is your XYZ looking like a zombie? That might be a clue that there's something wrong.
I think it's really important for people who are listening to understand that these receptors being stimulated by opiates, by really strong heroin, that we as physicians deal in what we call lethal dose. We have an LD50. And the more intense these narcotics are, the narrower that window becomes. And that's why overdose is such a devastating endpoint and why families are so devastated when a loved one overdoses. Because the person taking it doesn't realize that that window is narrowed. Talk a little bit about that.
That's a great follow-up to what we've just been speaking about. So I use the word tolerance. Tolerance means you need to have more and more to have the same effect. And here we're talking about the euphoric effect. Tolerance may or may not apply to different components of that. For instance, we don't become tolerant to the respiratory suppression. People die of opiate overdoses because the drive to breathe, driven by two key things, the amount of oxygen that we're circulating in our system and the buildup of carbon dioxide in our system. So if your carbon dioxide level is too high or your oxygen level is too low, we have an overwhelming urge to breathe. Opioids squash that. Don't feel the urge to breathe. And we don't become tolerant to the urge to breathe. We become tolerant to the sedation effect. We may stay awake. We don't feel tired. But when we go to sleep and are not paying attention and are alert to outside cues, our tolerance is not present for the drive to breathe. So people, when they take a nap on opioids and they're not tolerant to the effect of respiratory suppression, they die in their sleep. And that's the most common circumstance. And that's why we recommend to prescribed opioid users and anyone who has an addiction to opioids to have some of that Narcan around in the household at the bedside. And if someone looks like they're, you can't wake them up, that's obviously not a good sign. But if they're breathing irregularly and shallow, call 911 first. Give them a shot, give them a squirt up the nose, have it in your home at the time so you don't have to scramble for it, and introduce that, and you can save their life. Tolerance differentiates to euphoric effect, separate from pain effect, separate from respiratory drive.
And the stronger these substances, the less you have to play with.
And the more naive you are to them. So if you don't, you go to that party and you want to try that opioid, and it's a prescribed drug, so it must be safe. It could be an 80 milligram OxyContin, and to a non-tolerant person, one dose will kill. To a child, a tiny dose is lethal. To a pet, a tiny dose is lethal. So these are lethal with a single dose because different people have different responses in terms of respiratory suppression. So how sleepy someone is, they don't look so sleepy, they could stop breathing because that tolerance seems to be a separate mechanism.
I remember reading Keith Richards' book where he's talking about his heroin addiction, and he speaks about a mistake that a lot of heroin users have, which is after they become clean, if they go back, they go back to their old dose, but they're not tolerant to their old high dose and they overdose.
Yeah, and that seems to occur at about 4 weeks, but it cannot be predicted. And illicit drugs, we don't even know what's in them. So the potency of the drug, at least in prescribed, there's a sense, well, this is 5 milligram, this is 10 milligram. You know, fentanyl, we understand how much more potent fentanyl is to other drugs. So when we clinicians are prescribing them, we understand potency, and potency is associated with these factors. But to someone who takes a pill that they don't know what it is, or gets something on the street that is said to be one drug or another, it could be laced with fentanyl. And that currently is the steepest rising lethal opioid, because it's added to all sorts of other stuff called fentanyl, called even a sedative drug. You have no idea what you're getting, and it is, it's Russian roulette.
Before we move to treatment, speak really intensely about what's available now, I just wanted to touch on mixing substances, so alcohol and opioids.
Deadly combination. Most opiate overdose deaths on both prescribed and recreational circumstances are not opioid alone. They're combined deaths. Overwhelming majority, someone's taking something else with it. The most common is alcohol, because it's widely available. Alcohol also reduces respiratory drive. It produces sedation. It also induces vomiting. Opioids can induce vomiting, and vomiting and being sedated leads to inhaling your contents of your stomach, and that leads to what we call aspiration. But to the general public, that means drowning in your own secretions. So the other culprit agents are sleeping pills, all of them, Ambiens and the light drugs suppress breathing, sedatives that are of the benzodiazepine category, Xanax, Valium, clonazepam, all those drugs also suppress respiratory drive. And so these agents in combination with opioids double or triple the risk of an overdose death. So mixing drugs is a really bad idea. You may wake up dead, and your family will find you, and the grief and the suffering and the guilt lasts in your family members forever. It's not the legacy anyone ever wants to leave. And having, and as I'm sure you have too, Rich, met people whose loved ones have died of overdose death, they never recover. It's the saddest thing.
It's devastating.
It's devastating. So if you care about your family, it's hard to care about anyone when you're an addict. Talked about oxytocin and the binding. You lose your ability to have a social degree of connectedness where we can feel love, compassion, and empathy. It's just the drug. And that's very, very hard to even conceptualize. But seeing it and dealing with it on a regular basis, I can easily recognize how tragic it is with this dependency.
Let's go to then helping someone. Is there the potential of recognizing who might be more susceptible?
Well, we started with, I really like the way this drug makes me feel. So right off the bat, and that's self-perception. Or if you hear it, someone says, you know, this drug really makes me feel good. Or I've never felt this good before. First cue happens early. The other is family history. Family history is a powerful contributor. We don't know exactly the percent, but probably 30% of the development of addiction to any substance, but opioids included, can be gleaned from family history. We also know that being exposed to early life trauma, what we call the adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs in this field, leads to all sorts of dangerous behaviors. This is children and young adults being exposed to heavy threat. Their central nervous system changes in response to that. So people with significant adverse life experiences, post-traumatic stress disorder, child abuse, exposure to violence in the home, watching parents behave violently towards each other, having an addict in the, living in the household, using tobacco. So anyone who's still smoking tobacco has an addiction disorder. Having one addiction disorder is easily substituted with another. It's called transfer of one addiction to another. So people who go in for alcohol detox, they come out, they're solidly in AA, they're doing a great job with their steps. Well, I can probably try a little bit of oxycodone because I'm an alcoholic. I'm not an opioid addict. Any addiction, and using tobacco in this day and age when you know consequences, you know the compulsive use of it, and you know it's difficult to control. Those three C's, again, are a trigger. We don't know if other addictions like gambling or sex addiction and all the other conditions that people behave in a compulsive fashion flow over, but I would be safe. I'd put my money on the fact that any addictive behavior in yourself or a close family member puts you at risk and needs to be seriously considered, certainly recreationally, and even with medical exposures, that should be identified. You know, I have a lot of family history of addiction. I've had problems with tobacco. I'm hooked on tobacco. And the conversation with your doctor, can you please pay especially careful attention because I'm at risk? Please give me the pain relief. I'll behave responsibly. But keep an eye on me and pay attention to what I'm doing because you're prescribing this. I don't want to get into trouble. That would be a logical conversation to have.
Now let's move to what we can do for people. Somebody wants treatment, they come to the clinic. Tell the story.
Well, I'm going to put my primary care hat on right now. Most people see a family medicine or general internist or gynecologist or young people, a pediatrician as their primary care provider. And having done this, largely my specialty in pain now sees a different version of it. But putting that on in a primary care setting, walk in the office and say, I got a problem. I want to talk to you. That's the first thing. The clinician needs to be comfortable with the conversation. If you say, I have a little bit of problem with taking my pain pills, I'm a little worried about, and the doc says, don't worry about it, and changes the subject, that doc is not the one you should be talking with. It may be worth finding someone else. Because if they're not interested in such a potentially serious life problem, you want to find someone who's at least willing to listen. From the patient perspective, you need to be able to broach the subject. Or if the provider brings it up because they're being conscientious and brings it up, you need to be honest. Hard when you're hooked. Really hard, because people are going to be covering up. But if there is the question and you have a moment of willingness to disclose, go for it. Say, I think you're right. Let's talk more about that. Making the diagnosis needs to be determined that this is a problem. If you don't have the diagnosis, you're never going to get treated. Or if you present the diagnosis and no one's interested in hearing about it. So a family member, someone says, I'm a little worried about my medication use. That is a red flag, because people bring that up only when they're further into the throes of the issue. So if you are watching it happen amongst your family, friends, or loved ones, and you hear that, that's time to put your arm around their shoulder and say, hey, let's talk about this. I really care about you, and let's do something about it. So make the diagnosis from whatever circumstance. Opioid addiction is, in some respects, easier than some of these others. First, it's hard to get opioids. So you really have to go out of your way to get them or put yourself at extreme risk by purchasing street drugs. And the withdrawal of opioids, it feels awful, but you don't die of opioid withdrawal. Alcohol withdrawal or benzodiazepine withdrawal is life-threatening. But opioid withdrawal, you will survive. You may wish you were dead. It may feel like that, but people survive. But there's treatment that can prevent that. There are many remedies available. The most popular one right now and the most reasonable one is a drug brand name is Suboxone. Suboxone is a molecule that is very interesting. It has powerful, highly potent opioid. A very small dose, we're talking micrograms, is enough to produce an opioid analgesic effect. It doesn't stop breathing. It has 1/30, we talked about lethal dose, LD50. It's in some studies 1/30 the likelihood, so 300 times likely to stop your breathing. So it has this safety profile built into it, and primary care doctors can prescribe it right there in their office. It can be administered easily, once a day, put under the tongue. Every insurance company's covering it now because they realize that it's a very less expensive way than treating someone in ICU after an overdose method of treatment. Well tolerated, and it's not for life, but many clinicians will use it for 3-6 months, and if people go through the recovery process, recognize the behavioral treatments are necessary. Coaching, counseling, 12-step methods are fine, but most opioid addicts will not manage with a 12-step abstinence-only program. The data supports a 90% relapse with abstinence-only. Different for alcohol, completely different physiology recovery program. But buprenorphine is excellent. A more significant problem with opioids that can't be managed straightforwardly in a primary care office would be methadone maintenance, which methadone is a very potent opioid. They're dosed at a very high level, so there's no urge The euphoria is no longer present. People don't like methadone because, as we talked about, they're not euphoric. But they have such a high tolerance, they won't even feel heroin. You don't feel the effect of these other drugs. Therefore, it becomes an alternative. Methadone maintenance treatment is far safer than getting street drugs. The argument is, I'm taking another opioid, I might as well just get it on the street. The social and psychological consequences of illicit drugs compared to methadone are so much greater that the safety profile of methadone is available. There's naltrexone, which can be injected as a depot, more advanced drugs that can be used to help support that. But it's a combination in opioids of identifying the problem, communicating that with a healthcare provider. A specialist may be necessary, but a primary care physician or nurse practitioner at this point is licensed and able to prescribe the buprenorphine or the Suboxone products right out of the office without the stigma of being in a program. And this is best supported by understanding how else these people can find meaning and purpose and satisfaction in life, how they can fill their spare time, how they can find something to do with themselves and their mind without being in an intoxicated state. So there's a strong behavioral health component that needs to go along.
No, it does stimulate the receptors, but not in a stimulated way as somebody actually taking opioid.
It binds to the receptor nicely. So it prevents
withdrawal.
The withdrawal, okay. Which is a big problem. And it gets to a state of normalcy, but the euphoria is gone, and the euphoria becomes the problem. You need a substance to feel good. That's a problem for all addictions. We need to be able to find ways to be comfortable, to be happy in our own bodies without adding intoxicants. Intoxicant, the middle syllable is toxic. So to bring toxic substances into your body to feel good can't be good. That's the problem, and that's the challenge that individuals face. And there are well-established, scientifically proven ways that are safe and effective to manage addiction.
Now, can these eventually be tapered?
Yes. Yes. Depends on the severity. It also depends on the social support. The biggest determinant is how well you have functioned before. If your life has really been a tragic story of one catastrophe after another, no social structure, no job, homelessness, a real inability to socially engage, much more difficult to be able to engage. But individuals, many who are, assume are listening to this, the conversation, have had really successful lives. And in fact, they may feel so successful that nothing will ever hurt them. So they take greater risks. But ability to hold a job, ability to have friends, have a social network, to be part of a family, to be part of a community. These are very positive prognostic indicators for recovery. Recovery may start using these opioid drugs that I mentioned, the buprenorphine and the methadone. The ability to get off these is quite likely. It often occurs, but it's a process. And the process is not days or weeks. It's months or even perhaps a few years until the body recovers, the receptors recover. One recovers the strategies to live life without needing this euphoric sensation.
So going back to the primary care physician who can prescribe, the nurse practitioner who could prescribe, is that enough? Or would you recommend in your experience that that be coupled to some sort of program?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the behavioral component. Some people don't have access to that. They may be living in a rural area where there aren't counselors available. There is, for alcohol addiction, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. There's Nar-Anon for Narcotic Anonymous. There's TA-Anon for Cocaine Anonymous. All these groups overlap because the addiction disorder, ultimately, on a behavioral and social engagement perspective, are very, very similar. It's loss of control, inattention to the compulsive behavior, and it's neglect, and hence the consequences of that behavior. Those are what need to be addressed from a social and psychological perspective. If they're not available, buprenorphine is still better than nothing at all. Methadone programs all have that as a requirement. When buprenorphine was first introduced, a clinician couldn't even prescribe it without having a direct linkage to a behavioral problem. But let's get the flourishes off. Let's get to the bottom line. So the drug alone may be sufficient, but getting off the drug alone without the counseling, the chance of relapse is extremely high.
Okay, but people do recover.
Yes.
And with the right support circumstances, they eventually can go back to not requiring any supplement?
Correct. And I got to tell you, I've seen it so many times that it adds satisfaction to the work I do. It sounds like a grisly business taking care of this, but the satisfaction of people making those initial steps to recovery, becoming stabilized, no longer becoming zombies that we talked about, slowly coming down, becoming engaged back in life, is so satisfying. When your patient comes in and thank you, doc, for allowing me to get my life back, makes my day, keeps me in this business, and keeps your family doc who does this work satisfied and not stigmatized by taking care of those individuals.
Well, as we wrap up, I always like to ask, are there online resources or how do people get help who may not know about the clinic? Or what would you tell somebody who has a family member or the person who's listening who goes, I want help?
There is a crisis clinic telephone lines that are available 24 hours a day. You could even call 911 and say, I need to connect to a crisis clinic. You can look it up with the local crisis clinic. They'll give you immediate local resources. So if that urge is, I need help right now, you can make that reference. There are multiple addiction treatment programs scattered throughout the state, higher density in urban areas. Seattle, you don't have to go very far to find a provider of treatment for this. In more rural areas, it may be more difficult. If you have an internet or on your phone or in any other circumstance, all you have to do is addiction help, and you will have a huge list of both community-based resources, state-funded resources, private practice resources that would be available. There's no lack of ability to get pointed in the right direction. The problem is when that feeling, the urgency to get treatment wanes, I can handle it myself. You can't handle it yourself. It's a biological condition. I don't think people would want to handle their own heart attack. But this is more lethal. This is the opiate overdose crisis now is the third largest epidemic in the history of the United States. The flu pandemic of 1918, the AIDS crisis before effective treatments were available. And now, on a daily basis, more people are dying of opiate overdoses than they ever did even at the peak of the AIDS epidemic. So this is a major public health crisis. The state's working at a local level. The federal government's working at a national level. Millions of dollars, billions of dollars are being directed at addressing this crisis now. So there is access. I think the first thing to do is if you think you or your family has this problem, go to your drugstore and say, I need some of that Narcan stuff. So right away, you can have an emergency response.
Is that a prescription?
Pharmacists are now able to give it over the counter. It's statewide variations, but many pharmacists will be able to provide that even without a prescription. I think it runs $70, so it's going to cost something. Insurance plans cover it. And if you said, you know, I'm worried about a friend, I want to make sure I have Narcan available. You don't have to admit that you've got it. Or your family member, I'd like to have some at home and bring it over to their house. Anyone would give you that prescription. And if you hand your prescription to someone else, that is not considered illegal because it's not a highly scheduled drug. It's scheduled, but that would be considered good Samaritan behavior.
Would you like to see our population who is well-trained in CPR in Seattle, where, you know, bystander CPR is almost as common as a cup of coffee, carry naloxone?
That's the U.S. Surgeon General's recommendation, and I think that, you know, having everyone carry it is a big request. But anyone who's close to you, who you think may have a problem, I think that absolutely certain. All police officers now carry it. Of course, the 911 has that available. But if there's opioids in the house, the state law in the state of Washington is recommending on prescription basis that there be Narcan available also in the house in case there's an accident in someone who gets into it, add a drug and didn't know it was kind of an interaction or just simply an accidental setting. So it does cure it. It only lasts about 20 minutes, so you better call 911 too. It's not going to keep the person awake, depending on the length of the drug, but it will recover breathing, and the person may be angry. What are you doing? It can precipitate withdrawal, but you've just saved their life. That's what we want to be doing more of.
Well, that's a great way to end. Dr. Taubman, thank you. Truly appreciate this. It's overwhelming. It's a conversation people need to have. But thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me to have this conversation.
This completes another podcast chapter of the Washington State Urology Society's original Guide to Men's Health. This is Dr. Richard Pellman reminding you to take care of yourself. The Washington State Urology Society wishes to thank all contributors who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The Society also wishes to thank Sean Fox for his invaluable technical assistance. Music theme, San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. Dave Weidig. The podcasts are the property of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the express consent of the Society is strictly prohibited. For more information about men's health, visit wsus.org or visit your physician or care provider.